This week, on a special episode of WebMD's Health Discovered podcast, we're taking a closer look at a common form of lung cancer that accounts for 85% of all cases.
When I first heard the words, "you have lung cancer," I was in shock.
It's a diagnosis that changes everything. So what does it really mean to advocate for yourself when you're living with non-small cell lung cancer? Listen to Health Discovered on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Introducing Home Care Plus, a new subscription service from Lowe's that helps make life easier by giving members a hand with home maintenance. Let Lowe's tackle the tasks you keep meaning to do, like electric dryer vent cleaning, replacing hard-to-reach light bulbs, and more. Subscribe to Home Care Plus for just $99 a year and consider your to-do list done. Members get more at Lowe's. Available in select zip codes only. Cancel anytime. Non-refundable fee. Product purchase required. Terms and service restrictions apply. Details at Lowe's.com/terms. Subject to change.
Moro Casino. America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Yeah, it got crazier. Of course it did. The Nancy Guthrie investigation, as every time you tune in, you're like, huh? Really? This is what's happening. 3 weeks, 4 weeks in, 400 investigators, 40,000, 50,000 tips. The tip number goes up all the time. Zero arrests, no vehicle, no name suspect. That DNA hiccup that's going on, stuck in a Florida lab with challenges, according to Uber Chief Nanos. Check your local listings for showtimes on A&E. There's so many questions that are going on in this case, and now an offer from Savannah Guthrie of $1 million leading to the, and this is important, recovery of Nancy Guthrie. Savannah revealing the very real reality that I think has sunk in for her and her family is that this may be now a recovery operation and not a rescue operation. Joining me to discuss all of this, where the case is at, where it's going, Bob Mata, defense attorney, host of the podcast Defense Diaries. Let's start with the, there's a lot to go through. Let's start with the $1 million. This is new. This is an offer that she's putting out there for information leading to the recovery of her mother's body, her mother alive, if possible, but very likely we're looking at probably a body here. There's been some reporting that's gone on. And again, reporting everywhere, everybody's got their inside source. And then it's like the inside says there's no sources, whatever, that, that this is something they originally wanted to do, is offer $1 million, and Nanos said no, allegedly. What's your thoughts on offering $1 million reward at this point in the game, 4 weeks in, when she's likely already dead, to get some sort of information? Your opinion on that, Bob?
I think it's going to bring, you know, all the weirdos out.
Yeah.
You know, when it's that much money, the concern is always, you know, people are going to make plays for that kind of dough.
Sure.
It's as simple as that. You know, so I anticipate that the number of tips that come in will increase exponentially. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's going to create a situation where, you know, whatever these guys are doing with these tips that they're getting, and I think the last that I had heard that they had like 17,000 or 20,000 tips come in. And that was with the more modest 200,000 reward that was out there. And when you put $1 million out there, you're going to get all types, you know, so it creates a real issue for law enforcement to try to figure out what's legitimate to get through all the tips. Mm-hmm. First and foremost, it's just going to be a monumental task. And, you know, I get why she's doing it, you know.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it, like, the interesting thing to me is it at the behest of law enforcement that she ponies it up, or was she like, you know what, I'm like, I'm over it. And I'm, this is like my cash and I'm offering it up. I don't know. You know, it's not clear from the video exactly whether this is in tandem with law enforcement or this is the Guthrie family saying we're putting it out there because we want her back, you know.
And it's a tough thing because you're exactly right. You put more money out there. You certainly encourage more people to come out of the woodwork if they have information. But I think the argument has been all along, okay, $100,000, if you know something about this, it's a lot of money, without a doubt. But at the same point, is it life-changing money? Is it money, not necessarily like, I need to go get a new car. You know, it's more... I need to get out of Dodge and never be seen again by the people that I'm around because they'll probably try and kill me for snitching. That seems to be the carrot on the stick since the other ones didn't seem to move the needle at all. If you can put the carrot on the stick, at least that seems to be the thinking of life-changing money of we're going to get you enough to go hide somewhere and get off the radar and you can survive for quite a while on this. Maybe that will inspire someone to speak up and say, I know something. But then again, of course, the caveat is that waterfall of information, and you only have so many people that can go through the tips and process them in any sort of meaningful way. I mean, how do you find the happy medium there?
Yeah, it's hard to know. And you know, we're talking about two different things. I mean, this is a reward for a tip leading to either her body or her being alive somewhere, or it's different than a ransom, right? Yeah. You know, so, you know, I mean, are you talking about the perpetrator coming forward to get the money in exchange, or is it somebody that knows something that maybe is on the periphery that has been sitting quietly and, you know, I mean, if they have the knowledge but weren't involved, what does that look like for law enforcement in terms of do they make an arrest? You know what I mean? Like if you provide, which is another thing that I think that if you are a person with some kind of knowledge but weren't necessarily a part of it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, where does that put you in the minds of law enforcement in terms of are they going to charge you?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I mean, like, are you then at risk of becoming a suspect by way of having knowledge? Probably, you know, so it's a tricky situation, man.
It really is.
And it's sad.
And if you are someone who has inside intimate knowledge here, not just, oh, my neighbor's kind of acting weird, but more like you got the goods. You can point at the person and go, I know they did this. You might also be someone who has a bit of a checkered history, statistically speaking. So if you show up and go, yeah, this is your guy. And then they're like, okay, great. Let's learn more about you. Right. You may end up finding far more information about someone for unrelated crimes that could then be charged that person is in their best interest of not going down for. So I've never seen this done before. I'm just curious. You have far more decades in the legal world than I do. Have you ever seen a case where there's not only a ransom, because there's never been a ransom and a reward here. And that's what we're talking about. This is not an offer to pay a ransom. This is a reward where there's going to be some more boxes checked before any sort of, you know, money from the Guthrie's account moves hands. Have you ever seen a case where you have a reward of some sort, but maybe something beyond the money is offered? And this would be where law enforcement comes into place, whether it be probably federal authorities would be most likely where this would have to happen, of some sort of safekeeping of a, and this would not be the right lever to pull, but in the lines of the Federal Protection Witness Relocation Program, not super applicable in this case, legally speaking, but something of that nature of you come forward, we're going to help you in some way, shape, or form. If you need protection, if you need to disappear, we can offer that to you if you're in that sort of position. Is that a lever that's ever been pulled by the authorities or could be pulled in a situation like this to inspire someone to give the information that's needed?
You know, I mean, I think that they'd have to clear any kind of deal like that through the Guthrie family, obviously. Yeah. You know, I think at the end of the day, it's really those folks that matter most if there's some kind of determination. You know, where I see it, T, is mostly in proffers, wherein you've got somebody that's got intel and, you know, they're going in on a federal proffer where you're sitting in a room with a bunch of feds that are going to ask very pointed questions. And the rule of the proffer is you do not lie. If you lie, the deal, whatever it may be, is dead. And so you see that pretty frequently in federal cases where you've got somebody that's willing to be an informant. In a situation like this, it's just different, you know, because you've got the family that is out there putting out money, and you've got them wanting to either get their mother's remains back in order to bury her properly. And as she said in one of her videos, you know, celebrate her life. Or, you know, is she tucked away in some kind of cabin, you know, or down in Mexico somewhere? And, you know, ultimately, at the end of the day, is the family going to be willing to give that person a pass? I mean, and it depends on whether or not Nancy's alive or dead, right? I think there's probably a lot more room for forgiveness if she's alive somehow. You know what I'm saying? But the thing about proffers and most deals with law enforcement and or prosecutors is that they don't put them in writing, you know, and which typically means if they make an arrest on it based on a conversation that happens because of the reward and it leads to something, they're not going to necessarily feel beholden because they haven't put it in writing, you know, and it's one of those things where what is the person going to say if they happen to be one of the perpetrators? Like, oh, you screwed me on the deal. Yeah, you're right. We did. Gotcha. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it's a tricky situation all around, you know, from law enforcement side, from the Guthrie side, and from whoever, whether it be a perp or just somebody, like you said, with intimate knowledge of what happened here coming forward. There's a lot of moving parts, and how it would play out is kind of fascinating, because I can't think of a situation where you have a reward of this size, but you also have the concept, at least, of a ransom, which I don't know if anybody's still on that train. I'm not on that train anymore. I don't know that the ransom was ever a real thing. If it was, you know, I don't know if it went away because they simply lost Nancy in terms of she passed while they had her in their custody and they didn't know what to do with it. And no one's paying a ransom for a body typically. Maybe the Guthries would, you know, depending on how you wanted to translate that one video where she, you know, a lot of people were saying, oh, like, I think they're assuming that she's dead and it's a celebration of life. I got a lot of, I wouldn't call it pushback, but I got a lot of people thinking that was the situation when that particular video came out. So I don't know, man. It's, I don't know that it's going to help, to be honest with you, the $1 million.
Let's talk about one of the more recent statements that we have seen come out about an inside source saying that the video or that two of the images that we have now seen of the perpetrator on Nancy's doorstep, the initial reporting that came out just the other day. Oh, it's from two different days, by the way, two different, like, what? This is not all the same night of the guy on the porch. And then, just as everyone's getting excited about this, wow, he's been casing the place. The Nanos comes out and says, yeah, no, we don't really know about that. We're not really sure, basically. Here's what bothers me about the statement in general. Not just your source is wrong. It's not from the same day. It's more of we don't really know. This is data. This is images. This is video. And when you get it, and wherever they retrieved it from, however they retrieved it, there was timestamps. There's no denying there was timestamps on the data. How do you not know? How do you not know? I mean, I don't see any world in which that's a true and accurate statement by Nanos, that he doesn't know, unless he's holding back that information for some sort of investigative purpose on this, and releasing that publicly or acknowledging it would somehow harm the investigation. I don't know how, but that's the only thing that seems to make any sense to me. But to just flat out be like,
it's, I can't wrap my mind around it either. In all honesty, team, like I was, so when Allie and I did a live over on our channel last week, and I caught that. Like, yeah. I think there were probably some other people out there that caught it, but I was, because there was the photograph where the guy clearly doesn't have a backpack on.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, is this a second dude or what? You know, and like Allison was like kind of giving me some pushback on it. She's like, nah, I just think that you can't see the backpack. I'm like, you can't, that guy does not have a backpack on. So when that kind of broke, that story broke, I was like, wow. You know, and we were all talking about the fact that what they put out to the public did not have timestamps on it, which was annoying as shit, right? You know, the thing with Nanos is who can shut him down? That's what the problem is with them, because the feds have no control over him.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? It's like, I'm sure that they're in his ear and somebody has to be telling him to shut the hell up. Dude, just quit talking. Like, every time you open your mouth, you're not helping. As a matter of fact, you're hurting. And we're asking you, as politely as humanly possible, shut the hell up. Quit saying things publicly, because what you're doing ain't it. You know, so, I mean, sure, and the guy's elected. You know, I mean, what, like, can the mayor, who can remove him from that office right now? Because what I've seen coming from that particular office, and I'm talking about Nanos's office, has been absolutely absurd. He has spent so much time doing these individual interviews that I keep wondering, when the fuck is this guy actually working? Yeah. And then when he decides to say things, they're incredibly upsetting. I could not imagine being the Guthrie family and sitting there listening to that dude every time he talks. I'd be going out of my mind, man. I would absolutely be going out of my mind, because all it does is shines the light on the incredible incompetence of that department, which he is the head of.
Mm-hmm. Which you can watch on A&E every week, by the way. Now.
I mean, dude,
I'm not even kidding.
I know. It's like, I don't know how how did it take so long for people to figure out that shit was on A&E? Like it seemed like
it shows how few people actually watch A&E. I mean, it really does.
Yeah.
Like, oh, that's a thing.
No. Yeah. It's frustrating, man. It really is. And it's like, you can sense it. You can sense that, you know, the initial furor and everybody being out there, like CBS is leaving and media is leaving, and it's starting to, you know, it's hitting.
It's getting cold.
Point where it's not a story like it was. And now maybe some real police work can get done, because like, I don't know what his deal is, Nanos, but it's like, I'm at a loss with him. I can't understand how he thinks whatever he has been doing has been a good idea. I mean, is he married? My wife would be like, hey, Bob, you're acting like a fucking idiot. Yeah. You need to literally quit saying shit. You need to run whatever you're going to say through other people so that everybody's on the same page, so that it doesn't look like this is a disjointed nightmare, which is exactly what it is.
And look, here's my answer to it. I have no idea. This is my conjecture, my opinion. Personality disorders are neat, aren't they? I mean, that's the only thing that really explains it to me, because people that tend to have that, they live this disjointed, crazy life, and they think it's just smooth fucking sailing. Wow. And then everybody around them is like, what the hell are you doing? Like, what are you talking about? Like, who knows? I can't diagnose him. But I don't know. If I were to take a wild guess and go, what's going on with this dude? I'm going to guess we're going to check a box there, but it, all that does is define the behavior that we're already seeing. It doesn't really mean a whole hell of a lot. Again, that's just my conjecture. I have no idea.
It tracks. I'll tell it you does. That. It sure tracks because it's inexplicable.
Like, it explains there is no, the madness.
Right. Yeah. It's so weird. I've never seen anything like it.
Yeah.
It's like when you saw, because it's like probably closest to comparison in terms of like the national spotlight being on a story was Koberger, right? And
yeah.
And we know, like, those guys were just getting hammered publicly. Hammered. All mm-hmm. of them. Like, they don't know what they're doing. Like, from, and we talked about this a little bit last week, but they were but they didn't say shit until mm-hmm. they ended up arresting somebody.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They weren't doing this thing where they're coming out. And when they put any information out there, it had a very specific purpose.
And it tracked at the end of the day.
Totally. You know, and this shit is the diametric opposite of that. Like, it is. Like nothing that, I mean, yesterday, Allie pulls up something with two nice Mexican ladies that have come up to like dig holes across the street from fucking Nancy's house
mm-hmm.
because they think that that's where the body, you know, and like, and they had like 1.4 million people watching it. Mm-hmm. Like that's where we're at with this thing.
Yeah.
And I feel awfully terrible for the Guthrie family.
When there's a lack of leadership and direction, this is what you get. And this is one to be studied when all is said and done. Everybody's thoughts and opinions on the case, where it's at, give it to us in the comments on Substack or on YouTube. The links are in the description. Let's move over now to another fun case that we're all watching. I know you are streaming it over on Defense Diaries right now. Yep. Corey Richens. We've been waiting about 3 years for this to get underway in Summit County. Both sides have laid out their compelling narrative for the jury, if you want to call it that. Prosecutors painted a picture of a calculated killer who poisoned her husband for financial gain. The defense promised to show that the state's case is built on compromised witnesses and circumstantial evidence. Defense attorney Bob Mata with us from Defense Diaries, which you can get anywhere you get podcasts or on YouTube. Bob, now that we've seen both the opening statements, as a defense attorney, when you're watching both of these guys lay out their cases, just give me your reaction to both the prosecution and the defense. We had some interesting characters here. It felt like we had the uncast member of the Adams family, Bloodworth, but not just the name. He kind of feels like he could be Lurch's cousin in a sort of way. And going against Phyllis's sister from The Office as the other attorney. So I feel like we got like quite a match here. That's my take on their personalities. What's your take on what we saw so far?
I felt after openings that we're setting up for a hell of a trial here.
Yeah.
To be honest with you, I thought both openings were solid. You know, I thought mm-hmm. that Bloodworth laid out the state's theory very well. I thought that the use of the graphics that he'd.
Nope, Bob, you're muted. Bob, I don't know if you can hear me. Can you hear me, Bob?
Looks like we lost his audio.
I don't have audio from Bob right now. Yeah.
Oh, Bob,
oh, there you are.
Sorry, man. I think I'm on the phone, unfortunately, folks. So not optimal.
Okay. Give me your thoughts again, because you cut out for that whole little 30 seconds there.
Great. Yeah. Great. So, yeah, I was saying that I think that ultimately we're lining up for a hell of a trial here, and that I think that Bloodworth really put on an excellent opening in terms of laying out the state's theory. And I thought that the way that he decided to end it with the three images, coupled with the fact that these three images showed up on Corey Richens' phones 2 minutes after the ME left the house, it's pretty powerful. It's pretty powerful. And if you haven't seen the images, I think one was with a meme of Trump, you know, talking about being really rich.
Mm-hmm.
Another one with, I think it was Will Ferrell with money, or maybe it was Dumb and Dumb. I can't remember what it was, but guy with money on his, the thought being like, I'm in the money,
One was somebody wiping their nose with $100 bills. There was the I'm rich, and there was the idiots everywhere, right. Basically stating the circus of people in my house right now, idiots everywhere. Quite a weird thing to insinuate on the folks that have showed up trying to save your dead husband's life as he's laying on your bedroom floor. You're like, idiots. That's a weird thing.
You're innocent.
It's your innocent. Yeah. It's a weird, like, number one, I guess. Here's an interesting thing about this case that I said earlier today, and I think it's important to kind of have this, to run the prism of Corey Richin's actions through this to better understand them. It's like dealing with a very narcissistic 13-year-old girl, which a lot of 13-year-old girls are. They tend to grow up, though, and get out of that. It's a phase. It's not a lifestyle choice. I think Corey's never really left that. Because what grown ass, even if you did commit the murder, why are you sitting there looking at memes? Like, hey, I'm going to send it. Look at this. And I'm going to covertly send this secret message to my friend through a meme. And no one's going to know what's going on because it's all secret. Wink, wink. It's not like she like hid the Folgers crystals and he's drinking Sanka today. And it's a big joke. He's dead. Yeah. And this is what she feels appropriate, or that she feels she has the authority to do, the autonomy, but not getting caught. I mean, she thinks that she can do this and no one's going to be the wiser. That's just kind of what struck me of it. It'd be interesting. How do you think they're going to explain the memes away?
I don't know, because I was talking about it yesterday. I do not see any world in which Corey Richins is going to testify.
Yeah. Like
there is just way too much shit that she did that was super bizarre that I cannot. And I think she's a narcissist. Mm-hmm. And I think that we have that vibe that, you know, you get from all these guys who end up testifying that, yep, you know, you can sense that they're not going to be able to help themselves and that they're that guy that thinks that they could talk their way out of this shit. You know, your typical Murdoch and everybody else that we've mm-hmm. seen recently. And I think that her lawyers are going to pound it through to her. You just have way too much shit to answer for, you know, yep, with the walk, the dog, everything. Mm-hmm. And so ultimately, you know, how they're going to defend that is going to have to be an argument, you know, because mm-hmm. I don't think there's going to be the circumstance where they're going to be able to answer it without putting her on the stand.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like that there's no way to do it. Mm-hmm. So without her being on the stand, I mean, they can attack the recovery of the images through the extractions, maybe, but that's not going to suffice to a jury. Like the jury saw what they saw. Yeah. And you know, this isn't the 227, you know, house long to die in the cold bullshit where, mm-hmm. you know, I still don't know if that happened.
Sure.
You know,
yeah. Like,
this is an extraction and they pulled it off and they have the, you know, the, all the hash values of when that came off and the metadata, and they're going to know. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that she can. Yeah. You know, like it's going to have to be figured out by the attorney who's going to try to somehow explain it away during closing arguments, and whether or not that, because this is a wholly circumstantial case.
Yes, it is.
Like, there is no real smoking gun that exists in this case. And what seems to be kind of par for the course, unfortunately, this, you know, these days is it was a shit investigation. I mean, the woman wasn't arrested for a year.
At the end of the day, I mean, you can have two things simultaneously taking place, an absolute shit investigation and a murderer. And unfortunately, if you have the shit investigation, the murderer can go free. That's why it's so important that you cross the T's and you dot the I's and you don't mix it up and you don't screw that pooch as you're going along, which it feels like there may have been elements of this case that have that going on with it. Maybe not necessarily at the exact beginning, but who knows, as they're gonna try and poke holes any which place they can. Two things that they showed to the jury right away, and I was kind of surprised by, but I'm curious to get your thoughts on the opening statements of the defense of Corey Richins. It started with the 911 call played for the jury. Corey Richins in it. I just listened to it this morning again, and very emotional. not, I wouldn't say chaotic. I would say emotional, a word that I would use that I kind of gleaned out of it, felt ashamed. I felt a shame in there, but I could be completely off. It's just my own conjecture on it. I'm curious on your take. How did that 911 call, specifically the 911 call, read to you?
Well, if I were trying the case, I wouldn't have started my...
No.
I wouldn't have started my opening with it. Because it's one of those things where anytime you have 911 calls, you're going to get people that are going to figure that they've solved the case based sure. on what they're hearing. And was that a proper response? Is she faking? Mm-hmm. Does it seem performative? And, you know, I saw it flooding through my chat. Like if I were to use my chat as the jury, which I typically do,
yeah.
I'd say 9 out of 10 thought that she was faking,
yeah.
you know? And again, the reality is that every single human being on this planet deals with trauma differently, mm-hmm. you know? So I cannot with any kind of confidence at all sit here and say, oh, well, that sounded like she had been, you know, working up to doing, you know, making that call and you know, that it was pure performance and she wasn't really crying, you know, because when you couple it with the fact that we then see the body worn cam of when the first responding cop that gets there. And she, you know, everybody in my chat's like, she's not, there's no tears. She's crying. She's making the noise. It's that thing. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, there are people that exist in the world that whose tear ducts don't work, you know,
sure.
they can still cry. So, I mean, to me, the 911 call, I think was a mistake mm-hmm. only because of what people do with them. You know sure. what I'm saying? It's like the first thing that we're all trying to do is try to figure out if she's full of shit or not.
Mm-hmm.
Every one of us. You did it. I did it. Everybody in my... like. So I don't think, like, what is your net gain of that if you're the defense? You're not going to get everybody thinking that that's legitimate. You're going to have people thinking that it sounds like she's faking to me. You know, and I just, to me, it's not the kind of powerful tool that I'm using in my opening
mm-hmm.
To sway people, because I just don't think it's that piece of evidence. I don't think, you know, like Tony, we've both watched the Richard Allen interrogation videos and I watch those and I believe that they're indicative of an innocent man who's sitting in there.
Mm-hmm.
And if I were trying that case, and despite how much I feel like that, I would never have used them in my openings because everybody construes things differently. You yeah. know what I'm saying? It's like you have entire channels with body language experts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have, you know, there's companies out there that literally are being used in courts of law wherein they're talking about that they've created an algorithm that can indicate whether somebody's lying on a 911 call, and it's been found to be admissible in some courts in this country, which is insane.
Mm-hmm.
It's just absolutely insane. So I just thought that the 911 call was a tactical error. Like, I just wouldn't have used it. It was eventually going to get played. Mm-hmm. But, you know, depending on what lawyer you ask, you know, there's a lot of folks out there that practice law that believe that the cases are won or lost in openings. You know, sure. people form their opinions on openings, which they're not supposed to, because that is not yeah. evidence. You know, but humans, human, you know, and then that's people start making up their minds, especially if they've already come in with thoughts on the case.
Yeah, no, without a doubt. And I think an important thing to think about, too, when, like, listening to the 911 call, and there was the body cam footage, too, which I'm also curious to get your thoughts about. A lot of times we look at these things going, it's this or that. It's either 1,000% authentic, she is shocked, her husband just died, and she doesn't know what to do, so it's this. Or it's that. She's completely cold-blooded, she killed him, and she doesn't care, and this is all performative. There is a middle ground where actually... you can have a killer and someone mourning at the same time. And it happens to work. It happens to take place quite frequently in the personality disordered folks, the borderlines, the narcissists, things of that nature that are so far down that road where you can have it simultaneously going on. Now, the grieving is not grieving the way the rest of us would be over here of, oh my God, he's dead, as if she would be grieving because she's shocked at the loss. No, she could be grieving the change in the environment, the change of what's about to take place in her world, the fact that she got herself emotionally up to this point, executed the plan, and now he's dead. And now guess what? You get to deal with all this shit that's going on around you, and people are pointing at you, and people are starting to ask questions already. That could be the grief that we're seeing come out of her. Again, all conjecture, all complete conjecture, but it's not always just a this or that. What about the body cam footage? That was interesting to watch, seeing her in those moments as the officers were coming in, her trying to tell her story in some ways in kind of her sing-songy sort of way, and then looking for approval as she sing-songed her way through the explanation. That's the way I was kind of describing it. What was your take on the body cam?
I loved what you just said, because it's like what I'm always talking about. Like, we have no idea what Corey Richens' psychopathy is at all.
No, we don't.
We have no idea what's going on in her brain. And that concept that you're talking about is so fucking spot on, man, because it's one thing to think about doing something and maybe even going through all of the things that you need to do in order to accomplish what you're thinking about doing. And if that thing that you're thinking about doing is murdering somebody, that's a big task.
Yeah.
And a lot comes along with that in terms of emotions. And you have no idea going into it how you're going to respond, and not knowing how that woman's built in her mind. Everything that you said rings so true, because doing the deed, when the reality of it just hits home, in that flood of whatever emotion it is, whether it's grief, whether it's regret, whether it's relief, who knows? Mm-hmm. But you're going to be feeling something unless you're just a fucking robot, you know, unless you're just broken, right? So, I mean, I have to think that, you know, there's some kind of genuineness in there. What it means to her is unknown.
Yeah.
But, you know, you've got her covering her face almost the entire time that she's dealing with anybody, and that whether that's Wynn, who's the first responding cop from the Summit County Sheriff's Office, he gets there. She never uncovers her eyes, T.
Mm-mm.
You know, and he took that. He just finished his testimony today before I jumped on with you. Mm-hmm. And his thought, the last question the state asked him was, Did you think that her trauma response was normal? Had you ever seen anybody respond that way? And he thought about it for like a really long time before he answers, and he says, no. He's like, I just, the fact that she never uncovered her face was strange to me. And I was thinking the same thing when I was watching it. I'm like, it seems as if she realizes she can't produce tears, and whether that's biological or whether that's because she's just not feeling sadness or whatever makes her cry. And she just feels that she needs to kind of shield her face to mask that aspect of what's going on in that moment. I mean, I think the takeaway from it is it's not helpful to her. And again, no. I mean, how much weight do you put on it? That's up to every individual juror. I would put very little weight on it. And I would address it in closing saying, look, none of us know Corey Richens. None of us know this woman from a hole in the ground. We don't know what is normal for her and how she responds to trauma. You know, because it was just, and she did the same thing when the sister-in-law, Katie, came in. You know, still the same thing. With hiding the eyes, and it was just, it's off-putting to see it, because we all think to ourselves, that's not how I'd respond, but is that really fair? I don't know.
Well, I mean, and maybe it isn't. She's demonstrating grief. She's demonstrating trauma, but she's demonstrating it in an odd way, and it's hard to put your finger on. And I think that kind of goes back to what I said earlier of, okay, she's emoting something, and it looks on the surface like grief and shock. But what is the pain point here? Is it the same one that everyone else is feeling of Eric's dead and we're all crying? Or is her pain point something different? And that's what seems to read differently. And that's what I think makes her feel off, because in my opinion, I feel like her pain point is something very different than everybody else. I think she's emoting. I think she's having some genuine feelings there. I think there's probably a bit of performance going on, but I don't think it's all performance. I think there's some genuine grief and some genuine shock. But is it grief because she's never going to be sleeping in the bed next to her husband again? I don't think so, considering she was sending those memes out as they're zipping his body up in a bag and carrying it out of the house. But that's my opinion. The other tell point in there that I thought was interesting, and I'm curious if you saw this, when they brought up, okay, the officer tried to do it, you know, with kid gloves as nicely as he could say it without saying, we're going to go to an autopsy on your husband now. It was, you know, because he's healthy and he's young, we're going to have to take him in, and the medical examiner is going to, you know, basically he was alluding to, they're going to do an autopsy.
Yeah.
Her reaction, she was already up here, sitting up, was whoo, face down into the knees, head plant, far more dramatic than anything else he had just said. When he said, we're basically going to go take a really good, close medical examining look at what the hell happened to your husband biologically, chemically, in different words, her reaction was basically that of, oh shit. That I thought was very interesting, because if your husband just died of unknown circumstances, I think, I don't know, again, it's running, we all run it through our filter. My reaction might be, relief, good, please, let's figure out what the hell's going on here. Not, fuck.
You know? Yeah.
That was an interesting tell.
Yeah, it was, you know, because it's like, I always look at these trials that we watch, especially the murder trials, from two different perspectives. I always look at it from the perspective of the person is innocent.
Mm-hmm.
And if the person were innocent, what would you expect a response to be in a certain situation? And then I look at it from the perspective of the person is guilty. And what would you expect the response to be? If you're somebody who's been planning to murder your husband, you've already had this kind of kerfuckle go on with the $250,000 HELOC that you got caught pulling out without your husband's knowledge, you know, to the point where he's going to a divorce attorney and talking about, you know, divorcing her. So she's out there. She's mm-hmm. out there in these streets where people are not trusting her. Is she so thick that she wouldn't be thinking that if Eric dies under any set of circumstances, short of him being on a basketball court and having to grab her in front of everybody, that if he dies in the home, that somebody in the family, and I'm talking about the Richens family, is going to think that she had a hand in it. She had to think that, right?
You would think, but again, folks like that are so unaware of how they're perceived, because they think they're projecting this certain aura of themselves and no one's going to question this. But the reality of how people are perceiving them and their perception of their own reality are oftentimes so far apart. And that ends up being what takes them down. And I do wonder if that's what's going on here.
I mean, it could be. Like, the thing is, we just don't know.
No.
You know what I mean? And I don't know that her mental state is going to be addressed at all in this trial. So mm-hmm. frankly, that's going to be a question that's never going to get answered.
No, I mean, and it, you can't go and say, well, it turns out you got this disorder and people with this tend to do these things. That's not how it's ever going to work out. But just as we watch it, as we examine it, we try to make sense of the behavior. It helps create the roadmap of going, oh, they check that box and this box. And oh, they're just going down this road. And then, oh, okay, you can kind of see you can almost predict what the next move is going to be. Again, it's all of our conjecture and trying to examine the human behavior, and everyone is different. But there's a lot more to come here. It's going to be very fascinating to see where this goes and how this is argued over the next several weeks. I'm looking forward to the conversations. Your thoughts in the comments section on YouTube and Substack. The links are in the description. We will continue that there. Let's talk about Colin Gray. This is another case that's going on. I know you guys are covering it over on Defense Diaries as well, and you've been covering it since the beginning. Colin Gray is in Georgia right now. It's not just another murder case. It's a legal stress test. Prosecutors are charging the father of the Appalachian High School shooter with second-degree murder, not just manslaughter, pushing beyond the already unprecedented Crumbly convictions. The Crumbly set the precedent. Colin Gray's case is determining how far that precedent actually stretches into second-degree murder, not just manslaughter, with testimony revealing an FBI warning, a Christmas gift AR-15, and a father who said, "God, I knew it," within minutes of the shooting. This case could reshape how American courts treat parental culpability for years to come. Bob Mata is with us, host of the podcast Defense Diaries. Bob, the Crumbly's got manslaughter. Georgia's going for second-degree murder here against Colin Gray. It's a big jump. What is the prosecution saying with that move, and how much harder does it make their job here?
It's a tough road to hoe, man. Like, I mean, it's a challenge, because ultimately what they're going to have to do, and the way that it works in Georgia, is that they have this attachment of this predicate charge of cruelty to children. And that cruelty to children, if it results in death, allows them to go forward on this second degree murder. So, and again, he didn't have a hand in it, right? That's mm-hmm. what makes this case so challenging. Was this foreseeable? Yeah. Now, if you were to read the statute, the word foreseeable is not in it, but when you look at the jury instructions and you have an understanding of how they get to where they need to get a conviction of dad here, is it has to be shown that it was foreseeable, that he could have stopped it had he done anything. And it's a tough case. We're 7 days into it, and you know, I have very strong feelings about it. I have very strong feelings about parenting in this country. I have very strong feelings about parents being accountable for what their children do out in the world. And if you've done things or not done things that have put your child in a place where they are a threat, a serious threat to society, and not only have you not done what you need to do in terms of getting that child the help that they need, but you have enabled them to go into a school and do what he did by buying the kid an AR-15 after knowing that he had been on a Discord, or there was a thought that he had been on a Discord and was threatening to shoot up the school. And you still do that, man, you're going down in my book. Now,
yeah.
We all look at these things differently. Like, again, I always look at my chat, and that is always a reflection of society, because I have all people from all walks over there. And you know, it makes some people very uncomfortable. They think it's a bridge too far that they're charging parents for shit. You know, I get the, oh, now am I going to be held responsible if my kid shoplifts something? No. Don't be ridiculous.
Unless your child was sitting in his home with pictures of his favorite shoplifters posted on the wall, and he's sending you notes saying, if I shoplift something, it's on your hands. The FBI is coming to your house saying, there's something wrong with your son. This is pretty dangerous. And then they shoplift. Maybe that would be on your hands. Maybe you might be responsible for that shoplifting then. Maybe. Because this is exactly what happened here with murder. I mean, all of those things took place. All of those boxes were checked. And I get it. I mean, in your world, in my world, I look at this and we're like, of course. I mean, yeah, the kid there's nothing more he could do other than start firing it off in the house, right, and shooting the pets or something and going, I'm going to do this at school. Like, what more do you want? What more do you need to go? Your son is a danger to himself and others. But then we're also going to another human being who did not commit the crime and go, you better be smart enough to recognize this. And most people would be, but some people at the end of the day are just fucking idiots.
Yep.
And is he just a fucking idiot?
I mean, he might be a fucking idiot. I mean, the reality is that the further I've watched along in this trial, the more sympathy, and it sounds weird to say it, but that I have for that kid, Colt, man. Like, he was a kid that was rudderless. This kid went to seven schools in 4 years. His, you know, both parents were just shitbirds.
Yeah. And that's your dad, like, and mom. Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean? It's like this kid had, like, he was crying for help and they just wouldn't get it for him. And, you know, his grandmother, and it's his maternal grandmother, was really kind of his ride or die in terms of the one stable person that was a consistent factor in his life. And she couldn't really, you know, she couldn't even stop it from happening. And she did things, affirmative things, you know, to really try to fix the situation the best she could. I mean, it was a situation where she's calling, you know, DCFS on her own daughter. You know, I mean, she saw it and she heard the things coming from Colt. And, you know, it's like, it was just this perfect storm of awful parenting and, you know, a kid who's going through it and who's got some mental disease happening for whatever reason, whether it be nurture, nature, or both. I don't know. I have a feeling it was both.
Yeah.
But, you know, what the kid was just, he never had a chance. He never, never had a chance. And it was well within dad's reach to stop it. It's just, that's my opinion on it. No one's going to change it. I don't know if they're going to be able to produce enough evidence in terms of what he knew and what he didn't know. You know, there has been no evidence in terms of when the shrine went up, you know, but I'm like, I look at everything through the filter of me being a father.
Yeah.
Sorry. That's just how I'm going to view it. And I'm a good father. I'm an attentive father. I pay attention to my kids. I can sense immediately when something's wrong with my child because that's how I parent, you know, and I have those discussions with my kids and I hold people to that same standard. And if they can't do that and your kid goes out and shoots up a school and innocent people lose their lives and you could have done something about it, but you either elected not to or you just simply fucking ignored it, you're on the hook in my book.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I land on this thing. And because something has to change, because guns aren't going away. If y'all haven't figured it out, guns aren't going away. So
kids being raised by absolute shit parents is what needs to change, because our DFCS system is an utter joke. I mean, it sits there and it always prioritizes the blood relative as the reunification. Let's reunify no matter what. I see it all the time. There's a case in my world right now, someone I know, where this reunification bullshit is constantly pushed and the system just keeps pushing it. Why? Because the people who are basically having to check the boxes that they're doing their jobs, that's the best box for them to check. Not what's best for the kid, but because it's the easiest one to check. Because there's not enough homes out there for these kids, because there's not enough places for them to go. So the best thing is, let's keep putting them back with the shitty, abusive, horrible parents with a track record of shitty, horrible abuse and criminal involvement. The system still says, yep, they're best back over there. And I'm sure the system was saying the same thing here. Even if grandma was screaming, even if grandma's saying this is not okay, the system will continue to prioritize that because it always goes to the path of least resistance, not to the path of what's going to be best for the kids. That's our fucking problem, is our system is fucked. The system does nothing for the well-being of the children. It does what's easiest for it at the end of the day, keep some low-level people employed, and end up with a bunch of traumatized kids at the output of it. And we're like, well, too late. They grew up. That's our system.
Dude, it's broken at every level. Yeah. At every level. It's like from the Department of Children and Family Services, whatever you call it in your area, to the court systems themselves, to the guardian ad litems. Like every part of it is completely broken because you've got human beings doing the jobs.
And we're treating them like pegs, like pieces on a Monopoly board. We're not treating them like humans. That's the thing.
And it's like you've got like, and I don't know how it is in Arkansas, but here in Illinois, we have, if there is a battle over custody, if there's been something that has happened in the home and you have one of the parents that is having the child removed from them, and initially visitation is suspended, and then ultimately maybe they get back through supervised visitation with the kid, and you get these appointed, who are all attorneys in Illinois, these guardian ad litems that went for, you know, like 9 hours of classwork to go in, and they're the ones who in Illinois courts are the gospel. Whatever the judges take whatever these GALs say as absolute gospel. And, you know, they're going in, maybe they do a home visit, maybe they don't. Maybe they do it where it's unknown to the person that they're coming, and they're showing up out of the blue, which is how it should be done, because if people know that the guardian ad litem is coming for a home visit, then they're going to prep, they're going to clean. You want to see the house in its normal state. You want to just do a pop in and find out what is going on in that house. And it just, it doesn't happen. And you're talking about they'll have like two, three meetings with the kid and the parent and the other parent. And they're reaching these decisions where whoever they say should end up with the kid is who ends up with the kid. I mean, I have been in some epic battles where I'm like, you've got it wrong. Like you're being sold a bill of goods by the other parent. And I'm telling you, you got it wrong, you know? And it's like, and I'm just not heard, and I'm a pretty convincing person. So from every level, the system is broken, and I don't know what the fix is, to be honest with you. You know, I've seen it from the legal side, and I honestly cannot come up with a way to make this thing right. And I don't know that there's an answer out there that will suffice. You know,
I think it's dealing with reality on reality's terms and putting people in these positions with some sort of mental health education, because of which we have neither in the equation most of the time. It's very legalese spoken, and nobody is dealing with reality on reality's terms half the time. It's like, well, the system says we have to go towards reunification. Well, here's the shit show of what that means. Well, yeah, but we got it. Like it's so broken, and the tools, it's like we're asking an electrician to go and create a gourmet meal. And we're like, why is this not working out? Well, because that's not their area of expertise. That's why. And we're talking about minds and psychology and people and their emotions. And it's not spoken through legalese. It's not addressed that way. Yes, that needs to be part of the equation. But the big chunk of this, the reason we go in this direction or that direction, is based on the mind. And we're not doing anything to examine what's actually going on in the parent's mind, in the child's mind, and everybody in that equation's mind. And this is the shit show that we end up in. There we go. Problem solved. It's that easy.
Thanks, buddy. Yeah, I mean, it's you know, that mind thing is a pretty common theme through everything that we cover.
Yeah, a little bit. A little bit. You'd think like there'd be more weight on that in all these stories, but
so frustrating, man.
It is what we it is the world we live in. But so much, so many questions in this case, and it's still ongoing. And of course, you're covering it over on Defense Diaries, and we'll keep talking about it here as it continues on. Bob Mata, defense attorney, Defense Diaries. Go check it out. Go press subscribe wherever you get podcasts, Apple Podcasts, or on YouTube, and hit subscribe there. And leave us your thoughts in our comments section here on YouTube or on our Substack, Hidden Killers with Tony Brewski. Just search it wherever you get podcasts, press subscribe, and then again, leave us your thoughts. We always read the comments there. We'll continue that conversation there. Until next time, for Bob and Todd, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
John Daly here. You know what day it is? Neither do I. I live life daily. That's why I only spin on Moto Casino. Moto's got daily free bonuses, daily tournaments, new slots added daily. And the best part? Guaranteed daily jackpots. You can't beat that. So today's the day you grip it and spin it with me on Moto, America's social casino. Play for free on Moto.us.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Download the Moto Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Hi, Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Moto Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto, it's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino's the social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spend on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino. Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA. Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited. Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
It's tax season, and by now, we're all a bit tired of numbers. But here's an important one you need to hear. $16 billion. That's how much money and refunds the IRS flagged for possible identity fraud. But it's not all grim news. LifeLock monitors millions of data points per second and alerts you to threats you could easily miss on your own. If your identity is stolen, they'll fix it. Guaranteed. Save up to 40% your first year. Visit LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.